thinking he was a human slaver. Whole thing sounds like one of them, what do you call them? A metaphor. Cap tapped at her console. He was trying to make it seem like it was a baby Hrum getting his sugar. Like he was making some kind of point.
I don't know, Tolvren said doubtfully. He was pretty far gone. Not really capable of complex philosophical arguments, if you know what I mean.
Now something don't fit.
Tolvren studied the viewscreen to make sure that General Sloops continued with her toward the kettle. They maintained formation and followed her lead. Maybe he was feeling better as the sugar antidote worked its magic. Captain McGowan, rot his soul, kept his powerful task force back near the jump point. She imagined him in his quarters, reading a book and smoking a pipe, unconcerned about other developments. Cap and the others may make the occasional comment about the death cultists, comments ranging from suspicious to outright hostile, but they reserved their true vitriol for McGowan. Nothing raised one's ire like a backstabber. Except, perhaps, cowardice. McGowan stood accused of both.
Captain, Smythe said, the buzzards have changed tactics.
Bring the kettle up on the big screen.
Apex hunter-killer packs had been scouting the gas giant's ice ring for the past day, looking for Sentinel-3. Sometimes one of the packs had swooped at a spot in the ring, and Tolvren held her breath, sure that the Singaporeans had been discovered. But either the aliens were chasing their own tails, or they were trying to bluff the battle station into revealing itself. Nothing came of these charges. Now, instead of sniffing at the ring, they were blasting it with energy pulses. Tolvren laughed.
What are they doing? Hoping for a lucky shot?
Don't seem like that's going to work, Cap said.
Let them try, Tolvren said. It's like flying over a forest at 30,000 feet and hoping to shoot a deer hiding beneath the canopy.
This particular forest is a quarter of a million miles in diameter, Smythe said. It might take them a while.
He tapped at his console. But I'm not sure that's what they're going for. Smythe pulled the view out to show the entire gas giant, a roiling copper-colored world, its atmosphere filled with giant, Albion-sized storms in gold and burnt orange. The ring itself was thin, ethereal, almost invisible. Smythe and Lomelie changed filters and enhanced the view until the planet faded and the ice ring became a field of milky white diamonds. Or rather, rings, plural. Mostly ice, some rock. The enemy fire didn't look so random with a new filter in place. Instead, it became apparent that Apex was spacing its fire at even intervals around the ring. The energy weapons vaporized ice and rock, leaving a thin, empty slice in the ring when they passed. The ships then moved on to burn another hole. Other ships circled the ring, scanning instead of burning.
They are sure hammering away, Smythe said. We can feel it all the way out here. Could practically turn off the sensors and put a cup against the hull and hear all the banging.
So sound travels through space in your universe, does it? Cap said. A little muffled or what?
Smythe gave her a look.
That's one of your metaphors, Cap. You know that sensors have nothing to do with sound, right? It's not bloody sonar.
I ain't an idiot. You got a point?
The point is, it's not a very sophisticated scanning technology, but it seems like they have a strategy to make it work.
Don't mean it's a good one. Them Chinese know what they're doing. We couldn't even find them ourselves, remember?
Tolvren let the pair bicker for a few more minutes, then cut them off.
Smythe, what can we do with our own sensors?
Like Cap said, we can't find the battle station from out here. I wouldn't think we'd want to. If we shine a light on them, the buzzards will pick it up too.
That's not what I mean. What happens when we hit the enemy ships with active sensors?
I know that gives away whatever stealth we may have ourselves, but it makes a lot of noise. We can make it hard for Apex to hear.
Smythe's eyes lit up.
You know what would be even better? If we get the Hrum to join us. If each of those sloops picks an enemy ship, we can make that much more noise.
Excellent, Tolvren said. Get me the General.
The Hrum sloops were much closer now, with the General's flagship only a few tens of thousands of miles away, and there was barely a delay before a familiar Hrum face filled the viewscreen. It wasn't the General, but Della Zahn, the High Priestess. Cap muttered an oath.
I need to see the General, Tolvren said.
He is off duty.
Put me through to his comlink, please.
He is ill and not seeing anyone.
How about Lenel Tin?
The Colonel is not in command, I am.
Tolvren stared, disbelieving.
And this is the General's own wish, what he wanted? For you to be in charge of his fleet?
That is the order he gave.
That's not the same thing. Was he compelled to hand over command, or did he do it willingly?
The priestess didn't respond to the question. That was answer enough.
Tell me this at least, Tolvern said. Will you release him when he recovers from his sugar addiction?
That is no business of yours, human, but since you are no doubt burning with curiosity, this being one of the dominant urges suffered by your race, second only to greed and avarice.
Greed and avarice mean the same thing.
Acquisitiveness, the need to take from others to hoard.
Della Zahm tossed her head dismissively.
But since you need to know, apparently, in order to go confidently into battle, then yes, I will put Mosdries back in command once he recovers. I covenanted to serve the general until such time as he breaks with the humans. His wish is that I obey your orders, and this I will do zealously.
I have no doubt about the zealous part. Is that why you gave him the sugar antidote?
I did it to save his soul. The god of death had marked him for damnation. He must first free his body before he can free his mind.
You took him from command at the moment I need him the most.
This was not my desire nor my expectation. Mosdries is a measured man who took regular sugar rations. I thought he would recover quickly.
And would it have hurt you to wait a few days?
What do you want, Jess Tolvern?
Tolvern explained about using the active sensors to baffle the Apex search.
Far too much scheming, Della Zahm said. Humans and Apex are alike in this way. But yes, I will do this thing. It will be transparent to the enemy. They will know at once what you are doing if they do not already.
That doesn't matter. All that matters is that we make enough noise.
Understood.
The line went dead. The bridge seemed to exhale.
No wonder they keep the heat cranked up, Tolvern said. Della Zahm walks into the room and the temp immediately drops 10 degrees.
22 sloops of war joined Blackbeard in shouting with their active sensors at the ships of the enemy fleet. At first, the lances continued their methodical work on the ring, but within 15 minutes, the searchers began to drift, and shortly thereafter, the ones vaporizing icy cuts in the ring stopped too. The harvester drifted toward the ring. This made the lances jostle, and the 4 spears moved away as if in fear. Tolvern watched intently, hoping she was about to witness another struggle for dominance. Anything to disrupt the enemy. Maybe it would even break into a shooting fight. No such luck. Instead, the harvester seemed to be making a final attempt to provoke Commander Lee into a fight, but the sentinel stayed silent and hidden. The enemy fleet finally pulled out to the kettle's outer moons. There they organized and swung into flight. They soon took a course that would intercept Blackbeard and the Hroom fleet.
"Looks like we got what we asked for," Cap said. "Hurrah for us, eh, Captain?"
28 lances, 4 spears, and a harvester ship. There was no way Tolvern had the muscle to fight them all. Not without McGowan or the battle station to back her up.
"Someone tell me how long we've got," Tolvern said.
It was a relatively straightforward calculation based on current trajectories and acceleration, and Jane, the ship's AI, was the first to respond. She sounded almost cheerful as she gave the bad news.
11 hours and 47 minutes until intercept.
Cap looked glum.
"What do you suppose I taste like to the buzzards, beef or pork?"
"Beer marinated bacon," Tolvern said.
"Is that an actual dish? If not, it should be."
"You think it's funny, but look here."
Cap held up her left forearm.
"I got the bloody Albion Lions tattooed on my arm. They're going to take one look at this and think I'm someone important."
"You are someone important, Cap," Tolvern said. "You're the woman I'm going to finger as the captain of HMS Blackbeard when they take us prisoner."
"Is this one of those jokes you tell when they put a noose around your neck? Or do you have something you're cooking up?"
"A little bit of both."
"So you got a plan for real?" Cap asked.
"I hope so," Tolvern said. "Get that cultist back on the line. It's time to dust off an old Hroom trick."
Chapter 10 Admiral Drake jumped into the kettle system, expecting to see his forces already gathered at the battle station. With luck, Tolvern or McGowan, or possibly both, would be on Sentinel-3, stripping its weapon systems. Not likely, though. Almost certainly Commander Lee would require a report from Hillary Koh about Dreadnought's attempts to liberate Singapore before he turned over his tech. Drake hadn't yet come close to fighting the harvester ship devouring the Singaporean homeworld, but he'd fought a major naval engagement against the Buzzards harassing a refugee fleet. Add in the struggle against the Leviathan and the need to make a fresh attempt to reach Singapore, and he hoped Koh would give a favorable report. She had indicated as much, even though she'd often disagreed with his decisions during the past several weeks. With or without Koh's endorsement, Drake could prove his intentions. The bulk of Albion firepower would be in this system together with 30 sloops under the General, itself a massive commitment from the bleeding prostrate Hrum Empire. But the first scans of the system painted a dismal picture. A large fleet of lances and spears flew out from the kettle, where the signature of energy weapons indicated a battle had recently occurred. There were over 30 ships in all, including a harvester. Lloyd's scans found Blackbeard next. It was moving on a collision course with the enemy. McGowan was in the system too, but his cruiser Repulse and all of her support vessels loitered near a jump point far from the developing action. What the devil was McGowan doing? And where was the General's fleet?
"Sir," Lloyd said, "we found the Hrum sloops. Well, mostly."
Drake looked down from the viewscreen.
"What do you mean, mostly?"
"I'll show you, sir."
Lloyd divided the viewscreen into segments. At first, Drake's hopes soared. Over 60 sloops of war had been located in the system, more than twice what the General had promised. They flew in 3 different waves, each with 22 ships. And then the truth of the matter hit him.
"They aren't real, are they?"
"I'm afraid not, sir," Lloyd said.
His heavy eyelids drooped almost closed as he studied his console.
"A typical Hrum trick."
The Hrum had a technology that allowed them to project their fleet to other locations in the system. Whatever signal they gave off appeared at first glance to represent actual ships. In the early years of Albion contact with the Hrum Empire, centuries ago now, several battles had turned on these so-called phantom fleets, when Royal Navy vessels rushed off to fight a force that did not exist, leaving positions weakened.
"And if we spotted it so easily, there's no chance that the enemy would be fooled either, is there?" Drake said to Manx, whose initial response had been a sigh.
"You'd think Telvan would tell them not to bother,"
Manx said.
"Maybe she did. Most trees might not have listened to her."
"That didn't take long," Lloyd said.
"Confirmed, sir, this force and this one over here are both phantoms. The real fleet is the one near Blackbeard."
"Surely the Hrum weren't always this rigid,"
Manx said.
"I can only imagine Apex laughing or clucking, or whatever they do when they're amused."
"They express humor the same way they express any other emotion," Drake said, "with a celebratory evisceration of their enemies."
"The General let us down," Manx said. "No surprise, I never thought he'd get his 30 sloops."
"I never thought he'd get 20, Drake said.
"If the Hrum had that kind of force, wouldn't they be trying to save one of their planets? But he's got more ships than he left with, and I'll take it. Whatever we've got, it's time to bring it together. Lloyd, open a subspace channel."
"To whom, sir?" Manx asked.
"I don't know what the blazes McGowan is doing out there, but unless he's waiting for the Apex mothership, I need him in action and not sitting on his hands."
Drake composed the message and sent it to McGowan as soon as Lloyd prepared it for transmission. It was simple and unambiguous. Engage the enemy at once.
"We might have sold the Hrum short, sir,"
Lloyd said a few minutes later.
"Take a look at this."
Blackbeard and Mos Dris' ships were still 5 hours from the approaching enemy fleet, but matters had seemed to be reaching the point of inevitability. Except that the Apex ships were turning away from combat, swinging on a wide arc, they curved up on the Z-axis and hooked back toward the kettle. Drake couldn't figure it out at first. Why would the enemy retreat, even though they enjoyed an overwhelming advantage in numbers and firepower? Belatedly, he realized what must have happened.
"I don't understand," Manx said. "Why would they turn around?"
"They don't see Telvan," Drake said. "They must have lost her."
"But they're close, sir, and they're hitting with all their sensors."
"They only seem close from here, and that's because we can see what's happening. To the Buzzards, it's really not that close to be searching for a fully cloaked enemy. Their sensors are rubbish."
"But they must have spotted Blackbeard at one point to come rushing out like that," Manx insisted.
"We weren't here. We don't know what happened. Maybe Telvan showed herself to lure them away. Or there might be some other reason. But that Hrum trick seems to have thrown them off the trail. They may not have fallen for the Phantom Fleets, but they had to take a look.
and when they did, they lost track of Blackbeard and her ships. Could just have kept going and they'd have run into her, Manx said. I know that, and you know that. Apex doesn't. It's a good reminder. The enemy is not all-powerful and all-knowing. They can be outsmarted. Drake expected Tolvern and Mos Driz to slow their ships and allow Dreadnought and the rest of his fleet to catch up. Dreadnought was traveling uncloaked, brazenly showing her guns, daring the enemy to approach, taunting even. He didn't expect Apex to bite. They surely knew that Dreadnought wasn't alone, even though the rest of his fleet stayed cloaked. But Blackbeard and the sloops kept charging forward, headed toward the gas giant. That was concerning. Tolvern must have spotted Drake, so why didn't she wait for him? As for McGowan, he'd sent his task force in motion as soon as the Admiral sent the subspace. McGowan must have been positioned to fly toward the battle station and only waiting for orders. Some of Drake's anger faded. Maybe he and Tolvern had agreed to keep McGowan in reserve for some reason. Tolvern's subspace arrived just as Drake's ships crossed the position where she'd tricked the enemy into retreating. Apex searched with energy pulses, failed, left probes. Battle station did not see probes and tried to reposition. Location revealed. I am moving to assist. Drake suppressed a curse. Apparently bad luck and carelessness on Commander Lee's part had revealed the battle station, and Tolvern felt compelled to rush in to defend him. He thought about calling her back, letting Sentinel-3 make an accounting of itself, then bringing in the fleet for a decisive engagement with whatever enemy survived. But Drake needed the Singaporean weapons, and he'd promised to defend his new allies in return for their cooperation. "But I won't have Tolvern throwing away her life, either," he told Manx, "not to mention wrecking that magnificent Hroom fleet." Drake sent Tolvern a two-word response. Extreme caution. Tolvern laughed when she got Drake's subspace.
"Extreme caution? Is he serious?"
"It means he don't want us doing nothing stupid," Cap said.
"Like attacking an Apex fleet with a single cruiser and a bunch of Hroom sloops led by a death cultist?"
"He still thinks it's the general in charge there, don't he?"
"That doesn't change the facts," Tolvern said.
"There are 32 lancers and spears plus a harvester. I'd rather stick my hand into a hole and pull out a rattlesnake. You'll note that Drake didn't tell us to stop and wait, only to be careful, as if a warning does us any good."
"The enemy is jumping," Smythe announced.
Tolvern's forces were faster than Apex's, and she'd been gradually overtaking the enemy fleet. In another hour, she could have targeted the trailing ships with long-range missiles. But the Apex ships now jumped to safety, one by one. They reappeared about 1,000,000 miles beyond the Kettle's outermost moon. The Harvester ship was last to arrive, and when it did, the other ships formed a cordon to shield it. All eyes on the bridge were glued to the viewscreen. After days of slowly developing action, the next few hours would be thrilling. Would Apex make a charge at the battle station? That probe trick had been clever, and no doubt they'd kept Sentinel-3 in their sights. What about Lee's Illuminon battery? How would he put it to use?
"Maybe Lee got himself hidden again," Cap said.
The Harvester ship spit out 3 missiles. They started off slow and lazy, almost like torpedoes, but accelerated as they dropped toward the Kettle. When they reached the planet's ring, they banked hard. Green pulses appeared from the ring and blasted them apart.
"Nope," Tolvern said. "Not hidden."
"Lee, you fool. All you had to do was stay motionless. Now they've got you." Several lances peeled away from the Harvester and hooked around the planet. 5 more lances, together with 2 spears, swung into orbit around one of the larger moons. 2 more lances jumped away. Others crowded the Harvester ship.
"They're breaking up the hunter-killer packs," Smythe said. "What do you think that means?"
"They're taking cover," Tolvern said, "setting up to ambush us."
Cap grunted.
"At least they ain't attacking the battle station. Not yet, anyhow."
No, they weren't, apart from that initial trio of missiles, which appeared to be an exploratory barrage only. The enemy hadn't moved against the Sentinel. The Harvester was up to something, although it was hard to see what exactly, with several lances hugging its hull and blocking the view. There it was. The Harvester was opening up, releasing something. 10 large objects drifted away, then ignited their engines.
"Are those more lances?" Tolvern asked. "Don't tell me the Harvester is really a carrier."
"They are too small to be lances," Smythe said.
More like large torpedoes.
If you're right, Lee will shoot those out of the sky easily enough. Pilot, Tolvern said to Nib Pym, let's plot a new course.
Tolvern gave him her attention, and they worked out a course that would get her through the enemy ships and toward the battle station. She didn't have Sentinel III's exact position, but could narrow it down to a few thousand miles. When she turned back to the viewscreen, there were almost 30 of the autonomously moving torpedoes. They began as several small clusters, but dispersed toward the various moons around the kettle.
How big were the boarding craft the buzzards rammed into Blackbeard? She asked.
These are bigger, if that's what you're asking, Smythe said. And they have engines. I doubt we're looking at a boarding craft.
They had to be manned vessels, though, not merely floating bombs. Each ship was smaller than one of the Navy's own torpedo boats, but in sheer numbers they'd almost doubled the size of the enemy fleet. Only 4 lances and a spear remained near the harvester. The rest of the enemy ships, including the newly launched craft, formed a shell around the kettle and its ring.
I have no idea what they're up to, Tolvern said, but I like our chances. No way they can cover it all. We'll make a couple of maneuvers to throw them off our trail, and smash right through to the Sentinel.
They got a lot more ships now, Cap said.
I'd rather face 60 enemies under the Sentinel's guns than 30 out here on our own.
The Hroom High Priestess called Blackbeard when they were less than an hour from reaching the outermost of the enemy's forces. Della Zahm still wore her iron necklace, but had added an iron circlet to her brow.
Where is the General? Tolvern said.
I told you already.
But now you're wearing his crown.
For expediency, Della Zahm said. When the battle is over, I will return it.
Did you depose him?
Of course not.
So he's still in command?
I told you I'm in temporary command, but I'm only honoring the General's wishes.
Tolvern narrowed her eyes, studying Della Zahm for signs of deception. If the priestess had been human, Tolvern would have guessed an outright lie. Mos Driz might even be dead, but Ahroom would either have admitted it or refused to answer.
Did the General tell you to call, or is this your own initiative?
I'm calling out of courtesy, the priestess said.
You didn't answer my question.
Nor do I intend to.
So your own initiative, go on.
Della Zahm made an annoyed-sounding hum.
I see you're a stratagem, Jess Tilvin. I know what you hope to accomplish.
That's obvious enough. Stay alive until Admiral Drake and Captain McGowan join the battle.
In that case, your girls and mine have diverged.
You don't want to stay alive? I thought that was the non-controversial part.
My goal is victory. Yours is to live to fight another day.
I'm kind of aiming for both of those things, Tolvern said. Anyway, the best path to both win the battle and to stay alive is to concentrate all of our firepower, and that means hiding under the battle station's guns and waiting for the boys to show up to the party.
The harvester ship is almost unguarded. It is the perfect opportunity to strike a blow.
Even if it was unguarded, you just broadcast your intentions.
No, I didn't.
Tolvern was losing her patience.
You are going to form your ships into either the Claw Formation or the Wedge and make a run at the Harvester, which, being roughly as powerful as HMS Dreadnought and commanded by someone with far more imagination than yourself, will gobble up your fleet and spit out the bones.
Again, Della Zahm had nothing to either confirm or deny.
If you do this, Tolvern said, you are going to get yourself killed.
The God of Death will guide my hand as I obey his will, and if his will is that I die, so be it.
Let me talk to the General. I don't care how sick he is, I want to talk to him.
This is your warning, Jess Tilvin. Make your plans without taking into account the Hroom ships.
Chapter 11. Drake was so focused on the action developing on the viewscreen that he didn't notice Hilary Coe's agitation until Lloyd sent him a message bringing the woman's behavior to his attention. Drake looked up to see Coe pacing in front of the tech console, gnawing on the tip of her thumb and muttering to herself as she spared glances at her terminal. Drake called her over. Her eyes were bloodshot and her hair a mess, as if she'd run her hands through it too many times.
When did you last see your bed? Drake asked.
I don't remember. Yesterday, I think.
And if I query Simon, will the computer tell me you were actually asleep, or were you still interfaced to your workstation?
She glanced up at the screen, as if something had happened in the 5 seconds since she'd last checked.
Co, look at me.
Don't send me off, sir, she said. I've got to see how it plays out.
Sentinel-3 has been in battle before, Drake said. Your friends survived that encounter, and they'll survive this one.
Those are boarding craft the Harvester launched, she said. 30 of them. They're going in hard, and they're going to take prisoners.
Only if they can get past Lee's plasma emitter and the Eliminon battery. And only if Blackbeard and the sloops don't knock them around.
You said yourself you don't have much faith in the room.
No, Co, I do not, but they don't have to win the fight, only stay alive.
He raised his voice.
Diaz, how long until we reach the battlefield?
Give me one moment and I'll have your answer, sir, the pilot responded.
They're not invincible, Co, Drake said. This is a smaller force than we faced among the refugee fleet.
We didn't fight a Harvester, sir. With all due respect, neither of us know how we'll fare.
No, we don't, but you pacing and worrying is not going to tilt the balance.
Admiral, Diaz said, 5 hours and 47 minutes until we join the fight.
Drake nodded an acknowledgement, then continued with Co.
My better judgment says you need 10 hours off shift, completely disconnected. Dinner, a hot shower, sleep. But given the circumstances, 5 hours will do. No, he added, as she sputtered a response. It doesn't matter what Blackbeard and the sloops do, because you can't affect it. Co, I...
An exclamation from the tech console drew their attention. The enemy ships had been spreading out for the past couple of hours, but now they were on the move. A dozen lances leaped toward the gas giant's ring. They immediately began firing at a spot in the ring which lit up on the sensors as it returned fire. Twisting missiles raced out from the battle station, followed by globs of green fire from the plasma ejector. The plasma engulfed 2 lances and destroyed them. Other enemy ships squirmed to evade. Several more lances appeared from around the backside of the planet. Simultaneously, the Harvester, well beyond the action, fired a burst of missiles and smaller bomblets. They raced toward the battlefield, followed by a second, even larger wave. There were so many missiles, bombs, and ships, the sensors struggled to track them all. Meanwhile, the small boarding craft disgorged by the Harvester a few hours earlier suddenly veered toward the planet. The battle station was delivering a beating to the attacking lances, but the enemy was firing so many shots from so many directions that some of them got past the station's baffles. One penetrated the shields on the outer ring, and a bombproof burst.
"Get him off your back!" Co cried, as if Lee could hear her. "He's going to tear you apart!"
One of the Sentinel's batteries found the offending lance and attacked it with a barrage of bombs. Drake expected the lance to flee, but it sat there trading blows, even as the Singaporeans improved their targeting and hammered until it blew apart. Co gasped in relief and staggered for the nearest seat.
"That ship could have got away," Manx said. "It sacrificed itself."
"They're like wasps," Drake said. "The life of a drone is worth nothing so long as it gets in its stings before it's swatted."
Indeed, enemy lances were dying right and left, even though few of them landed the same kind of punishment before the battle station destroyed them. So far, 8 down, with a 9th making a futile charge and seeing itself knocked out of the action. And the Singaporeans hadn't yet fired up their Eliminon battery, or needed to. Even as he knew that all of this was preliminary jostling, Drake was mentally recalculating his odds. The more enemy ships that fell, the better his chances of taking out the Harvester with Dreadnought. Wipe away the support vessels and go straight at it. As for Sentinel-3, it was making a good accounting of itself, but its danger had only just begun. Co sprang to her feet again and came over to stand next to Drake. She stood there, running her hands again and again through her hair. 8 more lances jumped in. At the same time, the Harvester's missile barrage swarmed the battlefield. Commander Lee had his hands full trying to fight off this attack and keep after the initial wave of lances.
"The Eliminon battery," Co murmured. "Don't wait too long."
Drake started to think the same thing. The boarding craft came racing in. The Sentinel fired the plasma ejector again, burning up one of the smaller ships. 2 more fell to bomblets. These boarding craft had poor shielding, and to hit them hard was to destroy them. But the boarding craft were only 1 more thing on a battlefield now littered with ships and weapons targeting the Sentinel. Too many weapons were penetrating the battle station's fire.
"Here comes Blackbeard," Drake said.
"It's too late," Co said. "They're going to get through."
Drake wasn't so sure. Commander Lee only needed to hold on a few more minutes and he'd get relief.
It would be hard to watch Tolvern wade into the middle of that mess, but her presence was the only thing that could turn the tide. General Moe's Driz sloops had formed a claw as they followed Captain Tolvern onto the battlefield. Now the entire formation of 22 Hroom ships sheered off to Blackbeard's starboard. The Albion cruiser was alone as she came at the sentinel.
"Wait, where are they going?" Manx asked. "Why would Tolvern send them off?"
"It's not her. It must be the general." Drake suppressed a groan. "I thought he had more sense than that."
It was the same old story. Hroom commanders might behave strategically leading up to a battle, but once the fighting started, they wanted to land a deciding blow. And that was against the Harvester in this case. The entire fleet of sloops made a beeline straight at the Apex mothership. It didn't run, and none of the ships mauling the battle station returned to defend it. The Harvester held only a small force of 3 lances and a spear in reserve, which now moved to intercept the general's fleet. Still heading toward the sentinel, Blackbeard fired missiles as she entered the battlefield. Torpedoes followed, a barrage of Mark IVs and Hunter IIs. Drake clenched his teeth. Dreadnought and the rest of his fleet were still 4 hours from the fight. Captain McGowan's task force was another 11 hours behind that. Neither Albion fleet had the ability to influence the battle. Sentinel III kept taking blows. It destroyed another lance, but there were too many enemies. The Illuminon battery. Why wasn't Lee firing it? One of the boarding ships struck the station. A second hit moments later. They buried halfway in. The battle station kept fighting, knocking down more boarding ships one after another, but it couldn't stop them all. A third hit, then a fourth.
"No," Ko said. "Please, no."
Blackbeard, fighting off her own enemies, took out a lance with torpedoes and rolled to present a broadside as more boarding ships came at the station, escorted by 2 more lances. The cruiser spewed metal, destroying 2 boarders and wounding a lance. The rest of the lances fell back, but more boarding ships kept hitting the battle station and lodging. At the same time this was happening, the Hroom sloops had met the enemies flying out from the Harvester. The general's forces divided in 2, with roughly half breaking from the claw to face the spear and lances, while the others kept their hard charging attack of the Harvester.
"That will help," Manx said sarcastically. "What are the odds a single sloop escapes? 10%? Give them one pass and they'll be finished."
Drake stared, wondering if he was watching the last great Hroom fleet go to its doom, like a mass of cavalry charging fixed machine gun positions. For centuries, Albion had faced waves of sloops, like the one opposing the Harvester. More often than not, the humans had thrashed them, winning war after war. But the Hroom Empire was vast, or had been, and a few years or decades later, there would be another big war with similar results. Now the Empire was in tatters, its economy collapsed, death cultists tore it apart from within, sugar addiction continued to rage, and Apex enjoyed an all-you-can-eat buffet from the flanks. The once proud Hroom shipyards lay in ruins, abandoned or reclaimed by jungle. When Moe's Driz fleet died, there might never be another. Lances pierced a sloop with energy weapons, gas jetted from numerous wounds, and it limped away. Another took fire to its midsection and exploded. A third sloop came under attack and fled, pursued by a lance. The sloops launched serpentines, but none seemed to hit their mark. Meanwhile, the Harvester targeted sloops from the second force as it charged in. The general, or whoever was commanding the attack, launched waves of serpentines, which themselves spewed dozens of tiny bomblets. They splashed against the Harvester's shields, but did little visible damage. One sloop went down, then a second. The 10 that charged the Harvester quickly turned into 8, then 7. A hollow pit formed in Drake's stomach. Such wreckage, such waste.
"You were wrong, Manx," Drake said. "It's going to take 2 passes before they all die. Maybe even 3.
"They've still got to escape out the other side," Manx said. "Looks like they're going to ram it."
"My God, I think you're right."
All sloops had a Tyrillium ram on the nose, but ramming, as a tactic, hadn't worked in generations. Not since Albion altered their armor and the configuration of their bomb-proofs. Maybe it would work against a smaller ship like a torpedo boat, but that would just trade one ship for another, with the advantage to the Royal Navy.
Against the harvester ship, ramming was foolhardiness in the extreme.
"It's going to be like throwing eggs against a brick wall," Manx said.
That was more or less Drake's first thought. And yet...
"Where did the General get all of those sloops?" Drake asked. "There weren't that many ships to be had."
"He said something about neutrals and cultists and the like," Manx said.
"Right, death cultists. Like the ones who launched a suicide attack against Albion and destroyed Yorktown."
Drake paused.
"In an atomic firestorm."
"My God!"
The sloops kept barreling at the harvester. At the last minute, they all peeled away, except one. The final sloop slammed into the side of the much larger harvester. A flash, and the screen went dark as the explosion overwhelmed the sensors.
"They did it," Manx said. "By God, they took it out. A bloody suicide charge, and it worked. King's balls, I don't believe it."
"Hold your enthusiasm, Lieutenant."
Silence held on the bridge. Even Ko, who had been glued to the action at the Sentinel, stared at the half of the screen holding the action around the harvester ship. And then the sensors recovered. Drake's stomach sank. There it was, the harvester, still intact, still shooting at the sloops. But it had a gaping wound in its side, and wreckage spilled out. It listed, the engines pushing as something happened to its antigrav. It kept vomiting up debris and fell into a roll. Secondary explosions rippled along the skin. And then, just when it seemed as though it would break apart, it righted itself and limped away. The Hrum, had they possessed more imagination, could have fainted another charge, whether they had more atomic weapons and the cultists to make a suicide attack or not. That might have driven off the enemy for good. But having landed their blow, they were now fleeing for their lives. Explosions at the Sentinel drew Drake's attention back to the other battle. Blackbeard was knocking out boarding ships with every shot, and only one more had buried itself inside the battle station. But those who'd already entered were wreaking havoc, as multiple bursts of light attested. The birds were tearing it apart from the inside. The plasma ejector kept firing, but for how long? Blackbeard came in against the battle station trying to shoot the boarding ships from the exterior. Her deck gun hammered one of the boarders, and it popped like a giant bloody leech, draining gas and debris behind it. Suddenly the cruiser fell back. It was only a few hundred miles away when the battle station exploded. Debris and wreckage spun away. Secondary explosions tore into this. Large pieces drifted off, sparking, dropping globules of plasma. Blackbeard swung around and eased back into the debris, probably looking for survivors. Ko let out an anguished cry. Drake's stomach felt like cold cement. He rose to his feet and put a hand on Ko's shoulder.
"Time for you to go off shift," he said.
"They're dead. They're all gone."
"There might be survivors."
"Who? What?"
Her face was slack, and her voice sounded like it came from the bottom of a well.
"It's all done for. That is the end of us."
"Ko." She staggered away from him. Drake called the infirmary and sub-vocalized a message to the answering medic. "I need someone on the bridge. Bring a sedative." As devastating as the loss was, he couldn't pay it any more attention. Too much was left to be decided. The attacking waves of lances had been mauled and were falling back. They moved to join the wounded harvester ship, which was gathering the surviving Apex forces. Dreadnought was only an hour away from the battle and closing quickly. It would take Apex time to regroup.
"Notify the fleet," Drake ordered. "Drop cloaks, all weapon systems online. Let's finish this thing."
The harvester fled together with its support craft. They were still formidable in spite of their losses and numbered 18 lances and 4 spears. Against them, a battleship, 4 cruisers, 4 corvettes, a missile frigate, 4 destroyers, and 7 torpedo boats. Blackbeard snuffed around the wreckage for about 20 minutes, then moved to rendezvous with Dreadnought, giving Drake a 5th cruiser. The Hrum sloops joined them. Drake called Tolvern as they gave chase.
"I can't raise the General," Drake said. "Which one is his ship? Please tell me that wasn't him in that atomic fireball."
"No, one of his adjutants. She apparently overthrew the General, then took command of a sloop carrying atomic weapons."
"Really? Lennel Tin? I thought she was loyal. Or was it the older one? It must have been him."
"Neither," Tolvern said. It was a cultist by the name of Della Zahm, a high priestess to the god of death. She's a real piece of work. Or was, before she rammed her ship. I have no idea what happened to the general, if he is even alive.
We'll worry about that later. Can the harvester jump?
I have no idea, but I don't intend to give it a chance.
There was a hard edge to Tolvern's voice and a glint in her eye that looked a lot like bloodlust.
How is Blackbeard?
He smiled.
Don't tell me you've got her smashed up again already. I keep telling you to take better care of your things, but you never listen.
Actually, we're good. Poor Lee, he took all the fire this time.
That sat in the air between them for a long time. 11 years on his battle station, waiting. Break the silence, fight the enemy, and a few weeks later, Lee was dead, and with him most of his crew.
"Get me back in the fight," Tolvern said. "I'm ready, Blackbeard is ready, and we've got some Singaporeans on board who are itching for revenge."
"That I can manage. I'm sending you and Kate in for the first run, assuming we can get that close. Can you handle being her subordinate?"
"Obey Kate? Sure, of course. Just don't make me obey McGowan. We have issues."
"We'll talk about what happened later. Use the Mark IVs. They've got plenty of punch for what I'm attempting."
"Yes, sir."
"Good. Let's blow these damn turkeys out of the sky."
He cut the line. The harvester was still bleeding gas as it accelerated, and its engines responded sluggishly. Drake's fleet was closing the distance with every passing moment. The question was whether the enemy could jump to safety or would be forced to turn and fight. The back end was blackened and gaping open. The laws of physics meant that warp point engines would be positioned at the rear of a ship, but Drake had no idea if the short-range jumps worked on the same principle. And then lancers began to jump. The first ones appeared several million miles farther away, even as more ships jumped after them. Drake fought his frustration. The enemy was going to get away after all. Soon only the harvester remained. It accelerated, and then... nothing. No jump. After about 20 minutes, it decelerated as it swung around to protect its injured stern. Bomb bays opened, the laser arrays and missile batteries exposed as the harvester showed her teeth. The normally reserved crew on the bridge raised their voices in excitement and alarm. Calls went back and forth from the gunnery, incoming and outgoing messages to the other ships. Drake gave Kate's her orders, and Drake's 5 heavy cruisers pulled away from the fleet, followed by the missile frigate. He could use 2 more frigates for this fight, to trail the cruisers and bombard the enemy from a distance, but he lost 1 in the fight at the refugee fleet and the other to the Star Leviathan. They were devastating from a distance but vulnerable in a close fight. McGowan had 3 frigates in his task force, but he still wasn't anywhere near the action. The remaining frigate, HMS Ballista, launched a barrage of missiles that overtook the cruisers and raced toward the harvester. The enemy ship turned its energy pulses on the missiles and knocked out the first 1 dozen or so, before 2 got through and splattered against the harvester's hull in flashes of light. A second barrage followed moments later with similar results. The cruisers added their own missiles, 4 or 5 per ship, plus slower-moving, heavy Mark IV torpedoes. By the time the torpedoes arrived, the cruisers were already in close combat. Formidable and Zealand rocketed by the harvester's starboard, 1 after the other, their cannons roaring as they passed. Repulse rolled as it raced by the opposite side of the enemy ship. It, too, got off a full blast from its cannons. Explosions rippled across both sides of the enemy ship's hull. The human fire hit several of the warty protrusions that were said to contain either sacrificial victims or drones in stasis. They burst apart and spewed their contents into the void. The harvester was still targeting the mass of missiles and torpedoes, and failed to hit the first 3 cruisers as they flashed by. 2 of the torpedoes got through its defenses and slammed into the heavy bulbous head. The last 2 cruisers, Richmond and Blackbeard, captained by Cates and Tolvern, respectively, dove and then came up from below. They fired more torpedoes, charged ahead, as if they were going to ram the harvester, and then rolled away at the last minute. As they did, they got off more cannon fire, hundreds of tons of heavy metal, that slammed into the wounded back end of the ship. It was a hell of a bombardment, executed perfectly. All 5 cruisers had hit the crippled enemy ship with broadsides, while taking no damage in return.
In addition, they'd landed 3 torpedoes and at least a dozen missiles. Drake held his breath. Explosions continued to ripple along the front and back of the massive enemy ship. It was already wounded. Surely this would be the end of it. Nothing could stand up to such a massive bombardment and stay in the fight. The front end of the harvester opened its claw-like arms. Dark objects plopped out like droplets of ink. Engines flared to life.
"It's a bloody carrier ship after all," Manx said.
There were more than 30 of the small ships in all. Most chased after the cruisers, but several moved toward the frigate, which had paused its attack to reload its missile bays.
"Get Ballista back here," Drake said. "We can't lose our last frigate."
He'd kept his other forces organized on the wing, and now launched his 4 corvettes and 7 torpedo boats toward the fight, sending them to hunt down the enemy fighters. Only the 4 destroyers were held in reserve, as Dreadnought continued powering toward the harvester. Cates brought the cruisers together and regrouped for another run. Several of the enemy fighter craft broke through and charged at Dreadnought. They fired pulse cannons as they swarmed, but the battleship shrugged them off. Drake's destroyers turned about to hold them at bay, while he continued forward alone.
"Target enemy weapon systems," he said. "Take down their ability to hit us."
Soon, Dreadnought and the Apex Harvester stood within range of each other's most powerful guns. They came to and swung about to face each other. Dreadnought would move into place seconds ahead of her enemy.
"This is it, kids," Manx said, as silence fell across the bridge. "For the glory of king and country and all of that. Give them hell."
A calm, cool feeling washed over Drake, a kind of elation. His most powerful weapon against the Apex flagship. The enemy was wounded, but still formidable. He watched the viewscreen. Now.
"Fire at will."
Missiles, torpedoes, cannon. First the deck and belly guns, then the secondary battery. Finally, the ship shuddered as the main guns let loose with a barrage that put any cruiser broadside to shame. The enemy fired too. The space between the 2 ships swarmed with a thicket of weaponry from both sides. Bombs slammed into Dreadnought across the number 1, 2, 3, and 6 shields. Yellow lights flashed and Simon warned of damage. When the initial barrage ended, the enemy ship was smoking, but intact. It had hit back hard. Dreadnought had survived the encounter, but many more exchanges like that, and she'd be in bad shape. For a split second, Drake thought about withdrawing, making another charge with his cruisers, and maybe even surrounding the enemy ship and pinning it down long enough for McGowan's task force to join the fight. No, time to end it.
"Give me another broadside and mark 4s.
The cruisers were making another charge. Blackbeard and Richmond had turned last, but they'd slowed to make a more direct pass and were in the lead. The 2 ships came onto the other side of the harvester opposite Dreadnought. The other 3 cruisers came up behind them, slowing rapidly, until all 5 cruisers formed a row opposite the harvester, where they were perfectly positioned to enfilade the length of the enemy ship. Dreadnought fired another broadside. The enemy returned fire, but many of its weapon systems had gone down in the first exchange. It rocked under the bombardment. The cruisers launched a coordinated attack from the other side. Explosions bubbled along the hull of the enemy ship. The other ships in Drake's fleet had mopped up the enemy fighter craft, with only the loss of a single torpedo boat. Now they came rumbling in to join the fight. The harvester absorbed blow after blow until it could no longer return fire. Then it just sat there, taking hits. Drake's fleet pounded the harvester again and again until they'd gutted the engines, blown holes along the entire length of the ship, and burst all the warty protrusions. The harvester hadn't yet exploded or broken apart, but scan showed hull punctures that passed completely through the ship, shattering any airlocks or bombproofs.
"Hold fire," he commanded at last. "We'll save our powder for the next fight."
The guns fell silent across the fleet. The harvester ship drifted away, gutted and venting its life gases. A derelict. Drake folded his arms and enjoyed the cheers that went up along the bridge. He had destroyed an enemy harvester ship. Now the war had started. Let them come. He would destroy them all.
Chapter 12 Tolvern waited in the loading bay, the only somber place on Blackbeard. Everywhere else, people were celebrating their victory. Carvalho had brought out his moonshine and was passing it around to the increasingly drunk crew in the mess. Cap had put on music and the mess was soon rocking. Let them party. The list of battles and near-death scrapes they'd endured the past few months was almost too long to recite. But included giant toads, 80-foot-tall armored turkeys, and boarding parties where Apex troops had been trying to take them prisoner to eat them alive. Blackbeard had helped destroy a harvester ship and chased a fleet of lances and spears out of the system, and her crew deserved whatever celebration they could take. And since there was no port where they could put in to get drunk, gamble away their wages, and hook up with the nearest piece of ass, the ship would have to serve all of those purposes. Tolvern would rein it in eventually, or things would get out of hand. For now, let them have their fun. But here in the loading bay, things were different. Apart from Tolvern and Rodriguez, everyone on duty was Singaporean. A number had worked in Rodriguez yards on San Barondon. Others had joined the crew from Sentinel 3. The mood was like a funeral, as the crew caught the away pod from Dreadnought and hauled it in. Rodriguez fell in next to Tolvern and looked over the gloomy-faced Singaporeans.
It's a cruel universe. Every day is a gift. You might die of a heart attack or your son might go Nova.
The pod opened and Hillary Coe got out. Her face was drawn, her eyes red. Several Singaporeans approached and they embraced and conversed in Chinese. Others closed in and crowded about Ko. Tolvern and Rodriguez kept their distance while they waited for the woman to finish talking to her compatriots.
"Dying is one thing, seeing your civilization annihilated another," Tolvern said.
"Not sure I have a civilization," Rodriguez said. "My father was a merchant and we never spent more than a year or two in any one port. But I saw San Pablo devastated. San Barondon, too. I'm still alive. So are you and so are they. So, we carry on. What's next?"
"There's a lot of wreckage out there," she said. "Plenty of stuff to patch up whatever damage we've taken. We're running a scavenger operation while Drake plans our next move, but most of the repairs will need to be done on the fly. And by on the fly, I mean hurtling through space at near-relativistic speeds."
Rodriguez licked his lips.
I don't want to say I'm unwilling, but...
"Barker knows all about engineering in this sort of situation, and we've got people like Carvalho who are willing to do a spacewalk under frankly terrifying conditions. But you've got more experience cobbling together non-standard tech. And after seeing your makeshift factories on San Barondon, I'll bet you can reforge Tyrillium for us in a pinch. And complete other repairs as needed, of course."
"I'll have to see this wreckage, but sure, I'll do what I can."
"And you and Barker, how did the two of you get along?"
Rodriguez shrugged.
"He's a curmudgeon, grumpy, and sure he's always right, even when he's wrong. In fact, the more wrong he is, the more he stands his ground."
"And you?"
"Oh, I am at least as cranky. You get two hard-headed old goats together, and they're sure to lock horns."
Another, more exaggerated shrug.
"But I will work with him if he will work with me."
"Good."
Ko finished her reunion with the Singaporeans. She approached the captain as Rodriguez returned to his work.
"I didn't want to leave Dreadnought," Ko said, "but the Admiral claims you need my help. I know it's just to get me out of the way. I was bringing down the mood. They even tried to sedate me." "You suffered a blow. Maybe you needed sedating."
"I'm good now."
Tolvern led Ko toward the airlock doors, away from Rodriguez and the others.
"Are you?" "I'm a soldier, Captain. Death is always a possibility. I'll do my duty." "I'm glad to hear it. But you're wrong about something, Ko. Drake wasn't trying to get rid of you. I made the request."
The bridge was nearly empty. Smythe was down in the mess with Cap and the others, leaving Nib Pim at the pilot's chair and Lome Lee manning both the tech console and the defense grid computer. A midshipman by the name of Killian sat at the comm station. Tolvern gestured at the empty second mate's chair.
"Have a seat, Ko."
Ko eyed it doubtfully before sitting down.
"You are not nearly as formal as Drake. He's a bit tight around the collar. He's a professional, a baron's son. It's in his blood. But James is relaxed enough off-duty. Admiral Drake, I mean."
The other woman studied her.
"Do the two of you have some history?" "Why do you say that?"
I don't know, a vibe I get when the Admiral talks about you. Rumours I've heard.
What kind of rumours?
Nothing, it's just... You do, don't you?
Tolvern manipulated the view screen.
Not really, no. Not what you're implying.
Nib Pym looked up from his work.
Captain Tolvern is the daughter of Baron Drake Stewart. The Baron is the Admiral's father. Lieutenant Cap says that Tolvern wants to be Drake's lover, but the situation is improper. According to gossip, the Captain and the Admiral have not yet consummated their relationship, but both are anxious to do so.
Thank you so very much, Pilot, Tolvern said. You cut right to the chase, didn't you?
The room hummed.
Yes, that was my intention. Lieutenant Kerr seemed confused.
Lomelie and Killian exchanged grins. Tolvern flushed with heat.
Cap and Carvalho, on the other hand, are a different matter,
Nib Pym said.
I am not particularly interested in human mating behavior, but I have been told that they copulate as often as they can.
Anyway, Tolvern said in an exaggerated tone, I've hooked a large piece of wreckage from the Sentinel. I think it's the Illuminon battery.
She tapped at her console to shift the view on the main screen.
Here it is. What do you think?
The piece in question was a large hexagonal structure, scorched and twisted at the corners, but otherwise intact.
That's right. That's the Illuminon battery,
Ko sighed.
If only they'd fired it in time. Might have saved their lives, all right. Once the Sentinel was boarded, it was all over. No way they were fighting off so many drones. Why didn't they fire?
Tolvern asked.
Probably couldn't calibrate the graviton beams. They're finicky, and I know the pulsars had been knocked out of alignment.
Ko peered at the screen, manipulating the console without looking. Amazing how quickly she'd mastered the naval computer systems.
There's still power, she added. Do you see the light blinking on that strut to the left? The weapon has a battery for the battery, I guess you could say. In case you lose connection to the power plant, it takes so long to charge the Illuminon battery, and the last thing you want to do is have it bleed away while an electrician replaces a wire or something.
What are you saying?
Tolvern asked. Ko looked up.
I think you've got yourself a working Illuminon battery.
Great. Do you think we could connect it to a ship in the fleet?
Not Blackbeard. The power requirements are way too high. But Dreadnought, sure. I'd have to see the specs of a power plant, but Dreadnought runs with plenty of juice. That's glossing over a whole bunch of issues, of course.
Such as?
First of all, there's a reason we were in orbit around a gas giant instead of hiding out on some asteroid. We were swiping the kettle's gravity to recharge the Illuminon battery. That's not exactly the science, but more or less the gist of it. So Dreadnought could theoretically use the weapon, but it would need to camp out in orbit around a sun or gas giant every time it uses the weapon. I suppose you could do it around a small planet like Singapore, but it would take far longer.
And it's not exactly like plugging in a microwave, Ko continued.
You've got to integrate the battery with your fire control. I could manage that much, of course, if you gave me Smythe and Lloyd, and maybe this one,
she added, nodding at Lomelie, who'd come over to listen.
Then you've got the containment buffer.
What's that?
Tolvern asked.
There's a weird quantum effect that bleeds into the area outside the hexagon. There was a science museum in Panda City when I was a kid, and they had these mirrors where it looked like your legs were short and stubby, and your torso was elongated.
Funhouse mirrors, Tolvern said. I know what you're talking about.
That's what it feels like to breach the containment buffer, with a weird sensation of gravity waves melting and stretching your body. Nothing fatal, it's largely an illusion, but it messes up your equilibrium. Oh, and trashes your instruments, too, so you can't attach it to your ship without a buffer. I'm guessing we don't have a spare buffer lying around, whatever that is.
I'm sure you don't. And even if you had the equipment to manufacture a buffer, Ko continued, it would take weeks to integrate the Illuminon battery into a ship's hull, maybe months. You don't have that kind of time or the right facilities. You're better off hauling it into Dreadnought's loading bay. I think it will just barely fit, and carrying it back to Albion for later study.
I'm not even sure we are capable of that much, Tolvern said. When we started to pull in the Illuminon battery to let our people take a closer look, some of that funhouse mirror stuff happened.
Wait, really?
Ko's voice climbed in tone.
What happened exactly?
I had some crew suited up outside, and one of them tried to untether himself. He felt like he was upside down, and his computer freaked out and claimed his oxygen was low. Other people had that stretchy sensation you mentioned. Someone figured out it was coming from the Illuminon battery, and we let the tether back out again.
Ko zoomed in on the Illuminon battery and said something under her breath in Chinese.
How far out was the battery from the ship when your crew felt the effects?
I'd have to check, but I want to say a few hundred feet. It was pretty close in. I don't understand. Isn't that what you said we should expect?
Only when the battery is charged. The whole thing broke off before it could be fired.
Are you saying it still has a charge?
It must, if only you could... Oh my God!
Ko put a hand to her forehead and released a stream of what sounded like oaths.
Do you know what this means? Of course you don't. Why would you? Captain,
it's not like a battery holding electricity. You can't charge it and forget about it. You've got to constantly monitor the pulses, or they'll bleed out the storage. If there's a charge, it means there's someone alive in there.
Drake followed Lenel Tin down the corridor into the depths of the room sloop. It was narrow, with a high ceiling and smooth walls. The air was warm and humid, the walls humming with the sound of machinery and glugging pipes. And as the corridor twisted, Drake had the sensation that he was entering the intestines of a large beast.
"Was this your decision?" Drake asked. "Or did Delazam put you up to it?"
"The High Priestess is dead," Lenel Tin said. "She sacrificed herself in glory and honor."
"I'm not interested in her. I want to know whose idea it was to lock up the general before we went into battle."
"We didn't agree on the purposes of the Dark God, but I never doubted Delazam's devotion and faith."
"You are being evasive. Give me a straight answer. Who locked up the general?"
"I'm not being evasive. I have no straight answer to give."
"The general will tell me if you won't, and I'm going to get him out of there and back in command."
"No, you won't. Mos Dris will never again lead this fleet, and you will soon understand why."
This wasn't Drake's first time on a sloop of war. He'd inspected the wreckage of several, and every one of them had the same design. Two yellow-robed guards holding shock spears stood in front of the detention block, but Drake would have recognized it anyway by the narrow opening and the door that dilated like an opening sphincter. The first two cells were empty, but the third contained the general behind a clear plexiglass wall. Mos Dris still wore his white tunic with the sunburst on the chest, but his iron crown was missing. Shackles chained one ankle to the floor, and a wrist to the wall. Mos Dris sprang to his feet and tried to say something, but the wall blocked sound, and his thin, nearly non-existent lips were impossible to read. His face flushed pink as he grew more agitated, until his flattened nose was nearly red.
"So you did depose him," Drake said.
"No, I didn't,"
Lenel Tin said.
"Someone did, by God, and why is he chained?"
"He can be persuasive. Two different guards tried to open the door and let him out. Fortunately, they didn't have the electronic key."
"But you do."
"No, or I might have let him out too. As I said, he can be persuasive."
"Let me talk to him."
She reached for a keypad on the wall.
"Remember what I said. I know what you think you know about Room, but he will lie to you."
"This I have to hear."
Lenel Tin tapped the keyboard, and suddenly the general's voice came through, speaking his native language, with its collection of hums, whistles, and clicks that humans couldn't emulate.
"I can't understand that chirping, General," Drake said. "You know that."
Mos Dris switched to English.
"By the gods, I'm glad to see you here. That cultist locked me up and convinced them I was a danger. She wanted to control the fleet. I never should have brought her on. I had bad feelings about it. She agreed too quickly."
"That problem is over," Drake said. "She rammed a harvester and killed herself."
"That's what they tell me."
Mos Dris took his unshackled hand and twisted his wrist in the Froom manner indicating a shrug.
"What I don't understand now is why they don't release me."
He glared at Lenel Tin.
"Colonel, I mean you."
Lenel Tin looked away. Drake studied them both. The uncomfortable expression on the younger Froom's face, the anger smoldering in the general's eyes. What exactly was going on here?
"What happened to my 30 sloops?" Drake asked.
"By the gods, I tried. There were few to be had, and it took longer to persuade their commanders than I'd hoped. I might have found the last 8, but it would have taken me several more weeks, and carried me into hostile territory, where the cultists are even more zealous than De La Zam. The general hesitated. How many survived the fight?
17. We lost 5.
It could have been worse.
Yes.
Let me out, James Drake. I am the general of this fleet, nobody else. I serve the Empress, may she live forever, and by her pleasure have put my ships under your command. But I must be released.
Are you a danger in any way?
Of course not. I brought you your ships, didn't I? I have behaved honorably in our past transactions, have I not?
Drake looked at Lennel Tin. You really don't have the key to those restraints?
No, and neither does anybody else.
Then fetch a plasma torch and we'll cut them off.
I can't.
Are you claiming that you lack basic tools used in routine ship maintenance?
Of course we have plasma torches.
Then bring me one and let's get the general out of there.
Lennel Tin tapped at the pad, cutting off the sound from the general's cell.
I am disappointed, James Drake. I thought you would see through the general's lies. Humans have a reputation not just for deception, but for uncovering deception in others. Yet you were also persuaded.
Mose Driz has never lied to me before. The whom idea of deception is to refuse to answer a question.
The general doesn't lie, she said, but other people do. Come with me, I'll show you.
Drake cast a glance at the general, who was gesturing urgently, continuing to talk and plead his case. He looked absolutely sincere. And yet, so did his adjutant. She seemed both sincere and sorrowful. And there was something strange about the entire situation. Lennel Tin led Drake to the bridge. It was a large, round room, with room officers sitting in egg-shaped seats. They were eating their supper, served in square trays with molded cups for the individual portions. The food was green mush, pink mush, grey mush, and 3 shades of brown mush. Between the heat, the curved room, and the strange smell of room food, it was as if Drake had left the intestines of the strange beast and entered its stomach. The room all stared, and a few glared with hostility.
"You weren't entirely wrong, James Drake," Lennel Tin said. "I am partly to blame, as was the High Priestess. I am not a sugar-eater, but would never judge one who is. I know what sugar has done to our people, and even the most devout are not immune. But the General's addiction offended De La Zam. She convinced me to force him to take the antidote. Mosdries would be a better commander once he'd regained control of his faculties," she said.
"Tolvern told me he was off the sugar and suffering withdrawal," Drake said. "He seems to be over it now, though. There's even color coming back to his skin." He shook his head. "But your timing was poor."
"There was no better time. The general was in the sweating room, alone and vulnerable. He was running low on sugar, and I was sure it would be a quick recovery once he swallowed the capsule."
"What does this have to do with why he's locked up?"
"All this time I thought Mosdries was stubborn, an eater who couldn't leave the sugar behind for anything. What I didn't know was that the drug was covering up something more sinister. Once we took the sugar away, there was nothing to hold it back."
The colonel was still standing and tapped at the console next to one of the egg-shaped chairs. The viewscreen had been divided into panels, with one showing Dreadnought, another focused on Blackbeard and Richmond, picking through the wreckage of the battle station, and a third showing Captain McGowan's task force, as it finally arrived on the scene. These scenes vanished when the colonel touched her console. Replacing it was the general. He was pale in this view, and his hand shook as he wiped drool from the corner of his mouth. When he spoke, his words came out creaky as an old rocking chair.
"This recording is for Captain James Drake." He paused, grimaced. "Excuse me, Admiral James Drake. My mind is going, and I only have a few hours until it's taken from me entirely. As the sugar loses its effects, I fall under the sway of an Apex Queen Commander. Soon I will be hers entirely. My adjutants forced me to take the sugar antidote. You will know that by now, Admiral. If my instructions to Lennel Tin have been followed, they held me down and shoved the antidote in my mouth. I fought, spit out some of it, and swallowed the rest."
It proved to be a blessing from the gods that I didn't swallow it all. If I'd taken a full dose, the sugar swoon would have left me sooner. Instead, I've had these few days to see the addiction falling from my mind and to prepare. As for how the buzzards took me, the details are not important. They've attempted to control me from afar for some time now, but I've deceived them.
A whistle through his nostrils.
Yes, ironic, isn't it? A room deceiving an apex queen commander. If we could do that more regularly, perhaps we wouldn't be in this position. The queen commander, a brutal enemy by the name of Ak-Eek, gave me a vial of a serum to force into you, James Drake. Your mind would have gone the same way as Dijkstra and Megat's. You'd have betrayed your people and opened a path for the birds straight to Albion. I have put the vial in a stasis chamber with a randomly selected passcode, so that not even I could open it. This was to protect you, as well as give you something to study. You'll have to find a way to cut your way inside, but if your science officers want to study how the birds mean to control the human mind, there is your key. And next I will do the same thing to myself, put myself in restraints, and make it difficult to get me out. I'm leaving messages for my officers to tell them exactly what happened. Hopefully they will be smart enough to believe this message, and not the lying mouthpiece the birds will soon turn me into. And hopefully you will be too. Put me in stasis. Cut me apart to study, if you wish. But by all of my gods and yours, please do not let me live in this state of waking nightmare.
The transition ended. The viewscreen returned to focusing on activity among the fleet. A hollow, dead feeling settled into Drake's stomach. The poor devil. What horror.
"I will put the general in stasis and send him to your ship,"
Lenultin said.
"We will be safer with him there, and maybe at some point in the future your scientists will find a way to cleanse the alien serum from the brain."
"I agree. Freeze him, and I'll store his body in one of Dreadnought's stasis chambers. We'll help him later if we can. No guarantees he pulls out of this, but that goes for all of us, doesn't it?"
"Thank you, James Drake."
Lenultin nodded at one of the other whom on the bridge, who made a call. "Who is in command of your fleet, now that the general is no longer in charge?" Drake asked.
"Technically, I am," she said. "As the surviving adjutant, it's my duty to select two others for my triumvirate. But I was thinking of stepping down and letting one of the other captains of the fleet take my place."
"It's none of my business how you select a commanding officer. But can I ask why?"
"I am lacking imagination. Surely you have seen it. And there is another thing."
"Most room lack imagination. What's the other thing?"
"I'm terrified of leading my sloops into battle. There are so few of us left. If I make a mistake, I will wipe out the last remnants of Froom naval power."
"Ah, that. Being afraid doesn't disqualify you, Colonel. Only sociopaths, the mentally ill, and death cultists don't feel fear. The key is to learn how to control it. Can you do that?"
"I am not sure, James Drake. I am really not sure."
"Like I said, it's none of my business. But you did the right thing with the general. And I'd rather have you in charge than one of the cultists. Whatever your decision, I expect to know who is in command before we ship out. That gives you 10 hours.
Chapter 13. A week after the battle, Tolvern listened in growing disbelief as McGowan tried to justify himself in the Admiral's war room. The fleet was hurtling through space, and Drake had called over his cruiser captains for a council. McGowan started with a lengthy description of his non-adventures traveling from Albion territory to the Kettle system, then tried to explain why he'd lingered at the jump point while Blackbeard and the Hroom sloops made a desperate charge. There were multiple excuses which only made him sound more pathetic. McGowan's justification: he needed to guard the jump point. Who knew what might come through? Also, he wanted to keep his fleet intact. Oh, and since he and Tolvern were at loggerheads, he thought inaction prudent. After all, disarray in the ranks was dangerous. And finally, the Admiral's orders were too ambiguous.
This last bit was too much, and Tolvern could no longer keep her mouth shut.
Oh, please. How were they ambiguous?
McGowan crossed his arms. We were told to rendezvous at the battle station, not throw away our ships defending it.
And how were we going to rendezvous once it was blown into a million pieces?
Better to lose a foreign battle station than half the Royal Navy.
Good heavens, what kind of logic is that?
The impeccable kind.
Tolvern looked around the table to see if anyone else was buying this bucket of tripe. The captains of all six cruisers were present, plus the admiral, of course. In addition, Drake's pilot Manny Diaz was present, and the Singaporean tech Hilary Koh was supposed to be joining them soon. Diaz was studying his charts on the far end of the table and wouldn't be a party to this discussion. Of the others, Drake looked neutral, and four of the captains seemed sympathetic to McGowan's self-serving narrative. Even Cates, blast her. Cates was aggressive in combat. That alone should have put her in the opposite corner from her more cautious counterpart. Tolvern finally found a skeptical expression on Woodbury's face. Thank God someone wasn't buying it. Woodbury met her gaze and raised an eyebrow.
What do you think? She asked him.
I think 500 dead Singaporeans would have appreciated McGowan's ships. We were going to lose the Sentinel one way or another, McGowan said. Woodbury grunted. You have no way of knowing that. The Buzzards wanted it dead and didn't care how many ships they lost in the process. They were going to launch their boarding parties no matter what we did. Anyway, it all turned out, didn't it? Our fleet is intact, we have the Singaporean tech, and we wiped the floor with the Apex fleet. In return, we lost an immobile, poorly positioned battle station and a handful of Froom sloops.
What about the torpedo boat? Woodbury said.
A somber look came over McGowan's face.
Yes, there is that, a regrettable loss of life. And I understand that several crew lost their lives on Dreadnought as well, when she took enemy fire. But if you'd told any one of us a week ago that we'd destroy a harvester and half a fleet of lances and spears at the cost of a torpedo boat and a handful of other crew, we'd have jumped at the result. That's true, Drake said.
Was Drake out of his mind? Tolvern wanted to smack him. She glared, but he didn't look in her direction, and she managed to keep her mouth shut. Instead, she whipped a look at Cates, who looked thoughtful rather than outraged. Koh entered the war room and sat at the far end of the table with Diaz, a moment too late to hear McGowan's dismissal of Sentinel III's destruction. Too bad. Koh would have gone off on him for that.
Tolvern, tell us about the Illuminon battery, Drake said, apparently ready to move on. She unclenched her jaw.
There are three crew in the capsule, one of them Dong Swetnam. I hate to leave them dangling, but if we extract them, we rupture the containment field, and that will bleed off the stored gravitons.
Any trouble hauling the battery through the jump points? Drake asked.
No, sir, it's coming through fine. They've still got food and water in there. Scrubbers to keep three people in oxygen for a while. They don't have a solid waste recycler, and Swetnam says it smells like a latrine. But all things considered, that's the least of their worries.
How long will the oxygen hold out?
Hard to say, for sure. We only just got a comlink set up. Before that, it was all Morse code. Our best guess is 2 more weeks before the scrubbers begin to fail.
And if we tow them into battle, we can still use the weapon? Are we certain of this?
Tolvern glanced at Koh, who gave a curt nod.
That's right, sir, Tolvern said. They'll probably die if we do it, Koh said. You should be aware of that, sir.
You thought they were dead already, Drake said.
But now I know they're alive, and I want to keep them that way. Using the battery is a death sentence. The capsule has no armor. They'd be sitting out there while the enemy takes pot shots. How long would they last? About as long as it took the birds to spot them and figure out what was going on.
And you want what? Drake asked. To break the seal and let them out? That would wreck our chance of using the battery in combat.
Koh threw up her hands.
I don't know what I want. Sweat says he'll stay in the fight as long as we need him. But it seems a brutal decision to make.
This is war, Drake said. Brutal decisions face us all.
Koh leaned back and blew out air.
All right, I see. But don't throw away their lives. That's not too much to ask, is it? Make it count.
Of course, Drake said. Let's see the charts.
Tolvern leaned in as a chart appeared of the kettle system,
followed by the two jumps already taken. They'd first entered the Padang system, the final system before Singapore, only to spot a harvester lurking outside the necessary jump point that would carry them through. Drake backed them out and looked for another jump point. Now Diaz pointed to one. It would take them into what the charts were calling the Manx system, named after the Admiral's first mate. There was a jump inside a star, a so-called shattered sun jump, plus numerous other jump points.
"I thought all the jump points were bad," Tolvern said.
"They were," Diaz said. "But we've had a couple of weeks to study the data and upgraded a few of them."
"That doesn't usually happen, does it?" she asked.
"There was something funny going on. Could be a natural phenomenon, or it could be the buzzards were messing with us. They'd tricked us into jumping through, and clearly wanted to leave us bottled up for a while. If they could somehow spoof jump points, they could keep us chasing our tails."
She studied the chart.
"And now we have options, apparently."
"Don't forget that there's a star Leviathan in the system," Drake said. "It will have digested our frigate by now, and probably molted. We'll need to tiptoe past it."
"I assume there's a good reason we want to go through," Tolvern said, "or we wouldn't risk it."
"Wait until you see what's on the other side," Ko said. She clicked one of the yellow jumps, and another system popped up.
"It's Singapore."
"So we have to go through to get at the enemy," Tolvern said.
"That's what you're saying? It's the only way we can reach Singapore without fighting our way through Padang?"
McGowan leaned back in his chair with a thoughtful expression. "You can bet Apex knows all about that jump point. How can we be sure there's not an ambush waiting for us?"
Tolvern couldn't help herself. "Heaven knows you wouldn't want to scratch your shiny paint job."
"Tolvern," Drake warned, "let's keep this productive." "All I'm saying is we should be ready for a fight," McGowan said. "And if not in the Manx system, then the moment we jump to Singapore."
The Admiral looked resolute. "And we will be. We'll maintain the posture of our two forces, with a few minor changes. I'll be taking on another missile frigate for support, and sending the remaining Hrum sloops to the other task force. I need a second cruiser, and it makes sense to give you Blackbeard."
Tolvern was dismayed at the thought of serving next to McGowan, and it must have shown on her face.
"I could go instead," Woodbury said. "I have command experience and could take charge of the task force. Blackbeard could stay with the main fleet."
"No need for that," McGowan said. "I've got it covered. Tolvern's ship can lend me fire support."
"Or Peerless can support Blackbeard," Tolvern said.
"Don't be absurd," McGowan said. "You have no experience leading fleet operations. And if you think you're going to receive command because of your personal history with the Admiral, I don't think that will go over too well."
The pause before history was too obvious, and the smile on McGowan's face left Tolvern boiling. But she could hardly refute it without looking worse, so she kept her mouth shut.
"That makes the most sense from a logistical standpoint," Kate said.
Tolvern shot the other woman a look. Surely she wasn't buying McGowan's act.
"But if it were my decision," Cates continued, "I would place Captain Tolvern in charge of the Second Fleet."
"Another captain with all of 6 months' experience," McGowan said, his tone just short of a sneer. "Or is this a case of two women sticking together? Maybe you should form your own task force, the pair of you. We'll call it the Estrogen Brigade."
Cates' eyes flashed, and she looked ready to jump out of her seat. Woodbury's hand shot out and grabbed her wrist. He shook his head, and Kate settled back down. Her face turned placid, but when she spoke again, her voice held an icy calm.
"I was going to say that Tolvern should lead due to her superior experience. Yes, I said experience. In dealing with the Hrum. She has a Hrum pilot, and someone needs to manage the prickly commanders of the sloops of war. But there's a better reason," Cates continued. "You're too timid." Tolvern was right. "What the devil were you doing back there? We were fighting for our lives, and you were mincing in at the last moment, as dainty as a Yorktown debutante at her first ball. Did you even warm your cannons? They're not for show, you know. They're meant to be fired."
Tolvern grinned. Now McGowan looked like the one ready to spring to his feet and show his fists.
"By God, you take that back, Cates."
"Enough of this," Drake said. "I've seen McGowan in action. He knows how to fight and is a fine commander in battle. But Cates is also right about the room. We lost the general, and who knows what his replacement will do. Lenel Tin is no cultist, but that doesn't mean she'll obey orders if she doesn't like them. I want those sloops with the second force. I'm calling it Task Force Bravo. As for Telvern's experience, he gave McGowan a pointed look. She has plenty, and I have complete confidence in her abilities.
Telvern cleared her throat. I appreciate the vote of confidence, Admiral, but I am worried that McGowan and I won't be able to work together, after this exchange, I mean. Harsh words were said. That is, what if Woodbury were to act as my second-in-command? You take Peerless and give me Repulse.
I would agree to that, Woodbury said. Thank God, Woodbury would be the perfect officer to serve as the second in her fleet. He gave off a calm air with his measured gaze and monk-like appearance. More settled and mature than Cates, but not so old as to be hidebound. No, Drake said. I'm keeping Woodbury with me, and I have no doubt Telvern and McGowan will work together in a professional manner. Is that understood?
Yes, sir, Telvern said.
McGowan waited a moment longer, then nodded his head. Of course, Admiral. Good, Drake said. Task Force Alpha will be Dreadnought, 4 corvettes, 2 missile frigates, 4 destroyers, 6 torpedo boats, and the cruisers Richmond, Formidable, Zealand, and Repulse. Task Force Bravo will be Blackbeard and Peerless, 3 corvettes, 5 destroyers, 2 missile frigates, 6 torpedo boats, and 17 sloops of war. We must assume that whatever we face will give us one hell of a fight, Drake continued. So I don't intend to send either fleet off on chases. Bravo will force the action, and Alpha will finish it. Find the most powerful enemy first and push for a decisive battle. Any questions?
There were none, so Drake dismissed them. After leaving the war room, the other captains crossed the bridge to the lift that would carry them to their away pods. McGowan strode away, his face hardened into fury. Telvern lingered, so she wouldn't have to share a lift with him. She found herself waiting with Cates. The two women exchanged looks. Thanks for that, Telvern said. I wanted to bloody his smug, pretty boy face, Cates said. I know, right? My first mate calls him a piss nozzle. Seems appropriate. McGowan has too much luck with the ladies and doesn't know what to do when he meets one who doesn't swoon over him. Anyway, I'm sorry you have to deal with the jerk. Just make sure he gets his hands dirty. If he somehow comes out of the battle without firing his guns again, I'm going to throttle someone. Not much risk of that, Telvern said. He'll fight, by God. The door opened to the lift, and the two women stepped on. Drake hurried up and held out his hand, then joined them. He pushed the button to stop them, one deck short of the loading bay.
Telvern, I have a question about your guns before you go. It's the belly cannons we had installed on San Pablo.
Drake nodded at Cates as he and Telvern left her behind on the lift. What about them? Telvern asked when the doors had closed behind her. The guns are working fine. I use them every time I get in a fight. I can't say they've ever been decisive, but they give me an edge.
He waved a hand dismissively. No, nothing about the guns. I need to talk to you before you get back. We're dropping into radio silence. And who knows the next time we'll have a chance to chat.
Just a chat, sir? What about?
An enigmatic smile. About any old thing, Jess. No objections, I hope. And I don't care tuppence for McGowan's insinuations. They are rubbish.
You'd never give me command for personal reasons. You're not that kind of leader.
If anything, I'm overly cautious, Drake said. I know the rumors are out there, and I know what people are saying. I can't show favoritism because of a personal relationship, so I bend over backward and do the opposite.
Telvern stopped and crossed her arms. He stopped too and looked at her.
What? He asked.
We don't have a personal relationship, James. You hinted that at some point in the future, when things had settled down, well, you remember your spiel as well as I do. But right now, nothing. I've pretty much given up on it. That's fine. We are at war, it's improper, rules against fraternizing and all of that. But don't tell me we have a personal relationship, because we don't.
Why do you think I'm taking you to my room? She laughed.
Is that where we're going? We're not going to build up anything in 10 minutes of small talk. Or even warm up whatever we've put on the back burner. It's okay, I don't need your just chat right now. I'm busy keeping the buzzards from snarfing down my intestines. Maybe later, when I'm in a rocking chair by the fire,
I'll regret lost opportunities. Now I'm fine.
What if I were to invite you into my room and seduce you?
Don't mess with me, James. I don't have the headspace for it.
It's too late. I'm going to mess with you. It's all decided.
He turned and kept walking. They were, in fact, headed into the living quarters, where Dreadnought's officers kept their small private or double-bunked rooms. He stopped in front of a small side corridor that must lead to his chambers. Tolvern didn't move. She cast a glance over her shoulder toward the lift. A woman came out of one of the rooms, hand at her ear, talking to someone on the comm. She got on the lift. Tolvern almost told the woman to hold up so she could take the lift back down and get away from this nonsense. But something fixed her feet in place.
"You should see Malthorn's old quarters," Drake said. "It's ridiculous. There's no room on a starship for this kind of opulence. And yet that old villain managed."
"What do you mean?"
"Words don't do it justice. It's best if you see it with your own eyes. First thing, of course, is the bar. I have no idea how much those bottles of Old Earth whiskey cost, but something outrageous."
"I don't like whiskey, it burns."
"How about brandy from France?"
"You mean some colony of French speakers or something, right?"
"I mean the France, passed from one hand to another, through all manner of lawless systems."
Tolvern stared at him from several paces off. Drake wore a half-smile, and his posture was tall and proud. But at the same time, there was something vulnerable in his eyes. He was really, truly afraid she would reject him. And why not? Hadn't she been doing just that a moment earlier? She approached tentatively. He turned and palmed open his door, then stepped inside and waited. "Don't just stand there gaping. Follow him in." Tolvern made her feet move. As the door side closed behind her, she gaped at the high ceiling, the chandeliers, and the wide viewport that showed a swath of stars. At the furniture and the walnut bar, where Drake began to pour drinks from an unlabeled glass bottle. He turned as she approached, and his voice was husky.
"It's the best brandy you'll ever taste." He pushed the stopper down. "But I have something else in mind first."
And then he pulled her close and kissed her.
Chapter 14. Ak-Eek threw back her head and cawed. "Bring in the prisoners!"
A great cry went up from the assembled princesses. There were 20 of them in the banquet chamber. So many brilliant colors. And the stench of their secretions was so powerful that the drones staggered and drooped as they left the room to do the Queen Commander's bidding. The princesses were worked up by the battle, furious about their losses and greedy for more humans to feed on. They flapped wings, screeching and jostling. When another got too close, the offended bird cried out in rage and took a peck. So much power in the room, so many secretions from so many trying to rise to dominance. Alone among the princesses, Sewell M. didn't join the squabbling. But then she wasn't a princess anymore, was she? She stood off to the side, her wings extended to show the brilliant, almost radiant colors of her feathers. Her breast was red, the feathers on her abdomen shimmering gold, and her wing feathers were azure and green. Was it only Ak-Eek's imagination, or had her daughter physically grown since her own princess chicks hatched? No doubt that was paranoia. Sewell M. had reached her adult size years ago. But Ak-Eek eyed her daughter with jealousy and fear. This one was growing too powerful. And though she'd been promised her own flock as a reward for destroying the human military base, she seemed determined to aggrandize her position within Ak-Eek's flock. That would have to be corrected soon, or the queen herself would be threatened. "One misstep, daughter, and I will tear out your heart." Two drones returned to the chamber, pushing more than a dozen stumbling, naked humans. These were no Ladinos or Singaporeans, or even civilians, but warriors from the Albion fleet. Ak-Eek had been saving them in a stasis chamber for the past 3 months, ever since raiding a Navy supply depot on the edge of enemy territory. The drones wore disruptor vests, which they turned on the prisoners, bathing them in a pale green light that left them in a torpor. It was the same technology that the battle drones, fighters, walkers, and shock troops, used to subdue and collect victims, but at a weaker frequency. One man lifted his head and looked around, but though he was more alert than his fellows, his eyes remained glazed and wandering. The princesses stopped their preening and cocked their heads as the drones drove the humans into their midst. The drones turned off the disruptor vests and fled the room. One princess started keening, and the rest took up her call as they encircled the prisoners, until the banquet chamber rang with their cries. The humans came to as soon as the light fell off them. They looked around, eyes widening as they took in the chamber with its curving supports designed to look like the bones of a ribcage. The skulls of humans, Hroom, and other slaughtered species lined the walls. The room was designed to inflict terror so as to sweeten the flesh of its victims, and it served that purpose now. One human fainted, and two others fell to their knees, babbling for mercy. The one who'd remained more alert than the others shouted at his companions to stay together, to go down fighting, but few humans paid him any attention. Meanwhile, the princesses encircling them had resumed squawking and nipping at each other, each one anxious to be the first to feed. Several turned toward Ak-Eek, silently begging her to release them to their meal.
"Are we going to join the feast?"
Sul-Em asked.
"No, daughter."
"But I am hungry,"
Sul-Em said.
"And these ones are high status. They'll feed our power."
"You've taken too much power already."
"Too much power?"
A derisive shriek at this.
"I have my own prisoners. If you think that by withholding my rightful prey, you will keep me weak and subservient, you are wrong, Queen Commander."
"Rightful prey," Ak-Eek jeered. "I should pluck your eyes out. You were not even in the battle that secured these prisoners. You were too busy working on your human victims, learning how to control their brains. This is my prey, and I will use it as I see fit."
"How many more humans do you have on board?"
"Thousands. My stasis pods are full of them."
This was a lie. The Queen Commander had plenty of room, even a few hundred lesser humans on board, but these few were the only Albion warriors. Nevertheless, from the way Sul-Em greedily clacked her beak, it was obvious that the younger queen believed her.
"Thousands,"
Sul-Em repeated.
"Let me eat."
"No."
Sul-Em screamed in frustration. The princesses looked over, and several of the humans made a break for it. Before the princesses could react, the humans were charging. They fought their way through and ran for the door where the drones had disappeared. It didn't open, and the humans threw their shoulders into it to no avail.
"Feed!"
Ak-Eek screamed.
"Feast on their flesh!"
The princesses launched themselves through the air and fell on the humans. The prisoners fought back with their fists, but were no match for claws and beaks. Soon all seven of the runners had been dragged back, bloodied and gashed, to the center of the banquet chamber, where they were thrown down with the others. The princesses were more aroused than ever, and gobbled chunks of flesh until Ak-Eek screeched for them to stop.
"Bring me the leader, the one who fought."
They hauled the man to his feet, but his leg muscles were shredded and he couldn't stand, so they dragged him across the floor. A bloody streak marked his passage. Ak-Eek's stomach rumbled in hunger, and Sul-Em clucked as the two princesses dropped him and returned to the other humans. Ak-Eek pinned the man with one claw. He writhed, but couldn't get free.
"You will be the last to go," Ak-Eek told him.
He stopped struggling and looked up with a grimace contorting his face.
"You speak, and English too. What traitor taught you?"
"Your feeble human languages are trivial to master. A few minutes with a prisoner is all it took."
"Liar,"
the man said.
"It's a computer implant or something."
"Our brains are superior, engineered over hundreds of generations to dominate our enemies, just as our weapons and tactics are superior. We are the apex predator of the galaxy, human. You are nothing, a grub, a beetle, hardly worth bending to pluck you up."
The man spat at her, a gesture that not only failed, the spit fell back in his own face, but left Ak-Eek amused.
"We'll crush you,"
the man said.
"Wait until you face Dreadnought, then you'll see."
"You have been asleep. You don't know."
How long?
20 years. The lie tasted delicious on Ageek's tongue. His face paled.
Years? It can't be.
Yes, 20 of your human years. This is a celebratory event. Your warships are long gone. Your planets, too. We have just exterminated the last human colony, all the way to your homeworld and beyond, which makes the lot of you the last humans in existence. And that will make you the last human ever, once you watch your companions die.
Damn you!
Fluid leaked from his eyes, and his mouth trembled. Sul M and the princesses cawed and jeered at how easily the man had been fooled. Behind him, his suffering compatriots groaned and cried out.
Feed, Ak-Eek told her daughters. Feast and gorge yourselves.
They renewed their frenzy. The humans screamed. Sul M made as if to join the others.
Not you, daughter, Ak-Eek told her.
Again, Sul M cried out in frustration as the princesses tore apart their victims. In a few minutes, the last of the humans stopped struggling, and all that was left was the sound of tearing and swallowing as princesses dipped their beaks, tilted back their heads, and dipped again. Ak-Eek looked down at the man pinned beneath her claw.
And now I will eat their commander.
The man had gone still.
I'm nothing of the sort. I'm only private in the Royal Marines, so the joke's on you.
You are the leader here, and that makes you delicious.
He screamed as she fed. When the man stopped struggling, she tossed Sul M a strip of meat, which the other queen gobbled down before letting out a plaintive cry.
Please, Queen Commander, let me feed.
Very well.
Ak-Eek stepped back and Sul M swooped in. She tore and fed and was still eating after the others had finished their meals. The princesses waddled to the edge of the room, dull and sated. Drones would come and clean up the mess, eating everything down to the bones and hair. Ak-Eek expected Sul M to continue eating until she was fully engorged, but she stopped early. She eyed Ak-Eek with a cunning expression.
Your plan has failed, old crone,
Sul M said.
You tried to lay an egg in the enemy's nest, and it failed.
We don't know that.
You gave your precious room general a serum, did you not? He was to deliver it to the human commander, who would then turn traitor. Instead, you lost your precious harvester, and very nearly your life. If I hadn't carried you off with the fleet, you would be dead, and I would be queen commander in your place, instead of waiting for the bloody scraps you deigned to toss my way.
Ak-Eek clucked in dismay. The loss of her harvester was devastating. If not for the second command ship she'd seized from arrival 2 years earlier, she'd be without a harvester at all, and it would have been difficult, if not impossible, to keep hold of her flock long enough to build another. The other queens of the Apex race were struggling openly now, each jostling to become the Empress, and they would have fallen on her in a frenzy. Instead, Ak-Eek had sacrificed the crippled harvester to save her fleet. Then, by jumping sequentially across systems, they'd put distance between themselves and the enemy. Until now, they were approaching the final jump that would take them to Singapore. There, the other flocks were gathering. There, the humans would be lured to their death. This was a certainty. The doubts came over who would emerge on top. Ak-Eek needed Sul M until that happened.
You are still weak, daughter, Ak-Eek said. Your princesses are barely chicks, and your drone armies are no match for my own. Any of those princesses would take your place. If I give the word, they will tear you apart.
I will challenge you someday.
Yes, someday, but not now. You are feeble and pathetic, hardly a queen at all. I can pluck you any time I wish, and most likely I will.
A shiver went down Sul M's back from her neck to her tail feathers. She started to squawk a response, then only clacked her beak shut.
The Admiral is mine, Ak-Eek said. I will eat him myself, but you may have your choice of any of the other captains.
I want the woman, the one with the lone starship, the one who fought us at the battle station.
Yes, a worthy meal. Very well, she is yours, if you can take her.
Oh, I will take her, Sewell M. said. I swear by the blood of our victims I will have her.
One of our rivals tried to board her ship already, I understand. Her troops were slaughtered. A pathetic display.
And you just lost a harvester ship? Sewell M. said. Who is more pathetic?
Ak-Eek screeched in anger, while her daughter chortled in the back of her throat. Sewell M.'s insolence had gone too far. But rather than show her rage, Ak-Eek turned toward her other daughters. Listen to me, all of you. They lifted their heads and stared blearily in her direction. The meals they had been so greedily consuming moments earlier had left them in a bloated stupor, and they would want nothing more than to return to their roosts, tuck their heads, and sleep. I have made an alliance, Ak-Eek said. Eyes opened, heads lifted and bobbed. They squawked questions at each other. The Queen Commander continued.
Certain promises have been made. Some we will break. Others will bind us until we are more powerful. Until rivals have been weakened. But we must work with the other queens to lure the humans into a battle, and we must have their lances, their spears, their harvesters to be assured of victory. There are traps to set, bait to place. All of these things require help. The humans are strong, my daughters, perhaps the strongest race we have faced in generations. Their commanders are clever, their weapons deadly. All the more satisfying when we drive them to extinction. When that happens, the flock shall be reunited, an empress lifted above the others. Ak-Eek spread her wings. And when I take this lofty perch, my daughters shall all be queens. You will share in my power.
They flapped their wings and cried out in joy and bloodlust. As they did, Ak-Eek cocked her head slightly, so as to watch Sewell M. joining the display. Except for you, Sewell M., the only thing you will be sharing is your life's blood as I tear out your heart. Chapter 15 Admiral Drake's fleet had returned to the Manx system and set its sights on a jump on the opposite side of the system, a flight of 33 hours counting acceleration. After that, Singapore. Unfortunately, there was the small matter of a Star Leviathan to deal with first. With as much firepower as Drake had, he might theoretically battle the Leviathan to a stalemate, but it would cost him. He'd already lost a frigate, and easily conjured scenarios in which he fled for his life, while the Leviathan snarfed his cruisers and corvettes. So Drake figured he had two choices to get out of the Manx system unscathed. Most tempting was to simply slink all the way around the perimeter to get from one jump point to the next. He had a rough idea of where the Leviathan was lurking, and with a little caution could avoid detection. Unfortunately, that would turn a 33-hour journey into 140 hours. Drake couldn't lose 4.5 days. The other option was to cut straight through, but if he did that, he'd need a little trickery, or he'd be back to the fight-it-out-with-a-Leviathan plan. He had concocted a scheme and sent Blackbeard and Peerless, Tolvern and McGowan, to execute it. Drake was curious how they would work together. It was no secret that the two despised each other. Would it show in action? The rest of the fleet slowed, so the two cruisers would enter the asteroid belt first. A Star Leviathan was an insatiable eating machine, half organic, half mechanical. They could absorb all manner of punishment, indeed bombs and missiles seemed to only feed their hunger, and lay in wait to set traps. Once they hauled in a ship, it was done for, as witnessed by the unfortunate frigate. But they were still animals. There was no sinister intelligence guiding those tentacles and spore cannons. Blackbeard went in first, approaching the asteroid where the fleet had been ambushed a couple of weeks earlier. Anxious and incapable of affecting the outcome, Drake almost left the deck rather than watch. McGowan may have been spouting off, but he'd spoken the truth about one thing. Drake and Tolvern did have a history. First, on the estate, where Tolvern's father was steward for Drake's father, the Baron. Then again on Blackbeard, growing close as they faced danger together. And now, Admiral and Captain were lovers. That was Drake's doing,
and he didn't regret it for one moment. His memory of their lovemaking had a lush, dreamlike quality, and when he was alone in bed, he thought of her, remembering her scent, her soft skin under his hands, the weight of her body pressing down on his. But the unfortunate result was that his normal battle nerves were practically vibrating now. Jess was no longer just another captain in the fleet, if she ever had been. As Blackbeard approached, he braced himself for the dreaded sight of spores gunning her engines and a tentacle snaking out to snare her. Blackbeard peeled away at the last moment, dropping Yude mines as she did so. The mines had been pre-programmed to form a minefield and began to maneuver into a matrix. Peerless came up behind and turned to follow Blackbeard, spitting her own mines, which moved to join the first batch. Peerless launched a torpedo as the two ships fled. This had better work. The rest of the fleet was approaching quickly and would soon be in danger. Lloyd's hooded eyes widened.
"There she is, sir."
Drawn by the plasma signature of the two ships, the Star Leviathan slipped out from behind one of the asteroids. No, it practically was the asteroid, curled up around a hunk of rock that wasn't much bigger than itself. It turned its head and bunched its body in the way that indicated it was going to fire its spore cannon. Both cruisers were still in range. The torpedo detonated near the makeshift minefield. This set off one of the mines, which exploded. The Leviathan whipped its head in that direction. It launched from the asteroid, tentacles waving, plasma jetting out the backside. Once clear of its perch, the creature hesitated, clearly torn between going after the cruisers and investigating whatever had detonated. Surely it could see that the cruisers were big, full of all manner of tasty goodies, and their engines were giving off tantalizing signatures. Two cruisers would be an enormous meal that would let the Leviathan molt and spawn, if it hadn't already, keep it fed for years. On the other hand, the mines were just a snack, but they weren't fleeing either. "Take the snack," Drake muttered. "The meal is going to escape. You may as well go for the sure thing. Come on, take the bait." The Leviathan turned toward the minefield. Drake let out his breath. The relief on Dreadnought's bridge was palpable. The Leviathan reached the mines and stuffed them in its mouth like so many marshmallows. When one detonated against its tentacles, that only seemed to whet its appetite. A few minutes later, the rest of the fleet slipped past. Tolvern was first through the jump, but she wasn't alone for long. By the time she roused herself on the other side and was verbally shaking the others awake, McGowan was through, as well as several torpedo boats and a corvette. Details came back to her. She was in the Singapore system. At long last, the chance to fight a decisive naval battle. But first she needed the lay of the land.
"Smythe, where the devil are those scans?"
The tech officer was still rubbing his temples.
"I'm sorry, Captain. Blast it, these last few jumps have hit me hard."
"I'm on it, sir,"
Lomelee said.
"First scan's coming through now." "We're not hiding anymore, so hit them with the active sensors," Tolvern said. "Shine a big light and see if we can drive the vermin out of the shadows."
"Already doing it, sir,"
Lomelee said.
"Well done," Tolvern told her.
"Smythe, either snap out of it or haul yourself to the sick bay."
"Yes, sir. Give me a minute."
He was still grey, but responding coherently. The main screen showed the other ships popping through the jump and drifting away on auxiliary power to make room for the next vessel. Lomelee changed the view, focusing on a rocky world 200 million miles away. Tolvern was still woozy from the jump, just disoriented enough that for a split second she thought she was looking at Albion. It was blue and cool, with green continents stretching limbs into the ocean, and an archipelago of islands like jewels scattered across the water. But the continent facing them wrapped around the equator instead of the northern latitudes, and the poles were ice-free, as often happened when there wasn't enough land in the polar regions. She was staring at Singapore. It wasn't her homeworld, but it was someone's. Was Swetnam staring at the feed being piped into the Illuminon battery? If so, he must have a lump in his throat. Code 2 on Dreadnought. Here on Blackbeard, the Singaporeans would be swelling with hope to be back in their home system. but fear would settle into the pit of their stomachs when they saw what else the scan revealed. A harvester ship loitered above Singapore. Its main bay was open, with a continual stream of pods dropping out to descend into the atmosphere, while others returned with their harvest. Several smaller Apex ships hovered nearby. Like the others, Cap had looked up from her work as the scans came into focus, and she snorted as she took it in.
"They look so tough from here, Captain. Where's the rest of them buzzards hiding? That's what I want to know."
"You can bet they're out there," Tolvern said. "Keep looking," she urged the tech officers. Smythe was finally at work alongside Lomelee.
"Nib Pim, get us in there. We're leading Task Force Bravo, so it's on your shoulders."
"I am charting a course now, sir," he said.
"Enough gawking, the rest of you. We need to get positioned to protect the flagship as she comes through. Cap, get us out front. I'll put McGowan to our rear."
"Just where he likes it," Cap said. "Keep his toys shiny back there. Don't want nobody kicking dirt on them or nothing."
Dreadnought had just jumped into the system when Smythe detected a second force of Apex ships. Then a third. A dozen ships ranged between the orbit of Singapore and the final rocky planet in the system. And four more hunter-killer packs lurked near the jump point of the Padang system.
"Anything else?" Tolvern asked.
"Not that we can see," Smythe said.
"But who knows, we've been surprised before."
She ran some mental math.
"What does that add up to? 6 spears and about 40 lances? Plus the harvester?"
"We can take them easy," Cap said. "They've got a harvester, but we got Dreadnought. They got 6 spears, but we got 6 cruisers. 30 whatever lances, but we got about 50 other ships counting the room. We'll beat them."
"And I'm sure it will happen just like that,"
Tolvern snapped her fingers.
"Don't need to sound so sarcastic, Captain. We won battles like this before, ain't we?"
It took 2 hours to get the entire fleet through the jump and arranged into their component parts. Task Force Alpha set off first, led by Dreadnought and her cruisers. Tolvern was so impatient to follow that she retreated to the war room, so she could pace in privacy until it was time to get underway. But soon enough, Task Force Bravo was following. Drake wanted Tolvern's ships back far enough to be seen by the enemy as a reserve force, but close enough that the two elements of the fleet could quickly converge if someone sprang a trap. As for holding her in reserve, Drake assured her he had no intention of doing anything of the kind. When they got to Singapore, he was going to send his own cruisers to scatter the lances and spears, while Dreadnought pinned the harvester against the planet. Task Force Bravo would wait behind to see how this played out. If the lances and spears abandoned the harvester to its fate, Tolvern was to join her forces with Drake's cruisers and hunt them down. But if the enemy circled the wagons around the harvester, Drake wanted her to charge in, discharge the Illuminon battery, and then mop up the crippled remnants. Tolvern made a pair of calls before she left the war room. The first was to Lenel Tin, the new commander of the Hroom fleet. The colonel looked haggard, eyes drooping. An iron circlet rested on her smooth scalp.
"I am sorry about what happened to the general," Tolvern said. "I hope that when this is over, we can thaw him out and find a cure."
Lenel Tin whistled through her nose.
"I blame myself. I should have trusted him and not the High Priestess."
"Mos Driz also could have told you what was happening to him, instead of leaving you to guess why he wouldn't take the antidote."
"If we'd known, we'd have removed him from power."
"And probably for the best," Tolvern said. "He must have met with the buzzards, or else how did he get that serum he was going to give the Admiral?"
"True, true."
"Mos Driz was an honorable man, whatever became of him later. And if there's ever a lasting peace between our people, it will be because of his efforts."
"Your words are honorable, Jess Tolvern."
"Should I call you General now?"
"No, I am still a Colonel. Only the Empress can bestow that honor on my head. May she live forever. Perhaps if I distinguish myself in battle, she will see fit to elevate me to the position. Or maybe if I just survive."
A hum, and Little Tin sounded amused.
"There aren't many candidates left, and the honor such as it is may be fleeting, given the state of the Empire."
"You probably don't want to be a general anyway," Tolvern said. "I'm sure there are menus being drawn up across the Apex fleet with our names prominently displayed.
Why make it worse for yourself by claiming an even higher title than you've already got?
You are amusing, Captain.
Lemel Tin hesitated.
That was a joke, wasn't it?
God, I hope so.
So do I. It's either a funny joke or an unpleasant reminder of our ultimate fate.
In that case, let's call it a wry observation. I sent over our battle plans. Are you in agreement?
The operation is direct. Pin down the enemy and crush them. That suits room sensibilities. Usually humans prefer to lurk and avoid a direct fight.
We prefer a direct fight when the odds favor us. When they don't, we'd rather not throw our lives away.
Is that a reference to the death fleets?
Lennel Tin asked. Not at all. It means you'll be used in the same way I would use any of my other ships. Except that the sloops will fight as one unit. I don't trust myself to keep the other room commanders in line. I hope you can.
So do I.
All right. Tolvern felt she should make some final pep talk to cheer the room commander. But she couldn't think of anything to say. That's all I needed, Colonel. Best wishes to you.
And to you, Captain.
When the call ended, Tolvern settled into a seat at the end of the table, took a deep breath, and called Captain McGowan. His face appeared on the war room screen moments later. He eyed her with distaste.
What is it, Tolvern?
I want to discuss plans.
You do realize the enemy can monitor our transmissions, right?
We flooded the airways with fake signals.
A tactic Apex has already cracked wide open.
And we're transmitting with a weak signal that can barely cross the 50 miles between our ships.
Not a guarantee, Tolvern. Not at all.
She fought down her irritation. What do you propose we do? How are we going into battle if we can't talk? We have to coordinate, or we'll fall apart the moment the buzzards start shooting. Or is that your plan, to stay out of this fight, too?
You want to know why I'm hostile? He folded his arms. It's not because Drake gave you command. I don't care tuppence for that. It's because you keep laying on that cowardice crap. Do you realize how offensive that is?
You didn't show up, McGowan. That's why people are talking. You want to end the talk. You get yourself into the fight next time.
Look at my records. I've fought before, and fought hard. If you want to blame me for standing off instead of rushing in to help the battle station, go right ahead. But when you drop these insinuations, you're not only insulting me, you're insulting every officer and enlisted person on HMS Peerless. Now, more than that, you insult every man and woman on this entire task force, barring your own crew. Not one of us was in the last battle, and it aggravates us all when you claim that it's because we are cowards.
Tolvern blinked, surprised by the aggression in his tone. Was he right? Had she let her personal distaste loosen her tongue? I'll drop it, and with my apologies, too. I was wrong.
This time it was McGowan who seemed taken aback. He sputtered a little.
Never mind, that's in the past. What's this call about?
How are we going to get the Eliminon battery into battle?
Can't you just tow it in there and fire up the darn thing as soon as it's close to the harvester?
Not really, she said. First, we don't know for sure that's how it would play out. What if we end up chasing lances and spears around? We'll be dragging this large, obviously important object behind us. The enemy might not know what it is, but they'll start shooting at it just in case. But that's not the biggest problem.
How do you mean?
There's no anti-grav in the battery. The Singaporean crew is just floating around. That's fine so long as we're on a straight trajectory, but as soon as we start maneuvering, things get dicey. Won't take long for our Singaporean friends to get a bad case of interstellar whiplash.
Ah, got it. We're not going to be firing up the battery if those guys have been turned into meat puree.
McGowan tapped the side of his nose, a thoughtful expression on his face.
I have a spare inertia engine in my hold. Could we send over a crew and hook it up? Do you think we have time?
The problem is that weird gravitational field the battery emits. It will mess with anyone who gets too close. Hard to work when you feel inside out, and it seems like your legs are melting through the hull.
We've got a weapon, Tolvern. We must find a way to use it.
I could call the Admiral, but it feels like something we should resolve ourselves.
Agreed, McGowan said. Anyway, Drake is far enough away now that we don't want to hail him. The buzzards will pick up on it, and they'll figure out we're carrying the gravity weapon. How about this? What if we were to detach the Eliminon battery from Blackbeard and tether it to some other ship? We'll hold that ship in reserve until it's needed.
Suspicion bloomed in her mind.
Yeah?
Get over it, Telvin. That's not what I'm talking about. If I don't think we can afford to lose your shut-up ramshackle cruiser and its crew of misfits, then I'm sure as hell not going to keep my ship out of the fight. I'll be in the thick of it, whether you want me there or not. No, I'm thinking of tethering the Eliminon battery to a torpedo boat.
Ah.
That way, it will be on hand to deliver the cargo, whether Drake needs us chasing the buzzards or not. And we can spare a single torpedo boat.
I like it, Tolvern said.
Good. Anything else?
No, that's all. Oh, but McGowan,
she said, making sure to keep her tone one of friendly rivalry and not hostile,
we'll soon see exactly how you stack up against this ramshackle ship and its crew of misfits. You might find that Blackbeard can hold her own.
He chuckled, seeming to take it in the spirit it was offered. There's a reason my ship is called Peerless, Tolvern. It's not just a name. Try to keep up, will you? And with that, he was gone.
That was almost reasonable, she said aloud.
I'd say, a voice said behind her. Tolvern turned to see Cap standing in the doorway. A smile crept up the corners of the lieutenant's mouth.
Don't tell me you fancy the bloke now, Captain.
God, no. Good, cause he's still a wank weasel.
Anyhow, I thought you were still sweet on the Admiral. Or did you give that up?
Now it was Tolvern's turn to smile.
No comment, Lieutenant.
Wait a minute, Cap said.
You didn't, did you?
Is that what you was doing over there?
I thought it was a big important meeting of cruiser captains or something.
Ease up on the throttle, Cap. Your imagination is out of control.
Are you telling the truth?
About what? I haven't said anything. Cap's eyes narrowed, and she studied the captain's face. All right, then. Keep your secrets. Anyhow, I thought you should know that we found some more enemy ships, and they are headed this way.
Chapter 16 Drake studied the approaching ships to see what they do. Even as the mood on the bridge grew tense, there were only 6 lances. Not enough to threaten the massive Albion force, but enough to prove an annoyance. Manx cleared his throat.
They look ready to jump, sir. Pilot, how long until we reach Singapore? Drake asked.
Diaz tapped at his screen.
14 hours, sir. And the other enemy forces, when will they arrive to reinforce the harvester?
More tapping.
18 hours and 20 minutes for the closer fleet, 19 hours for the other. So we'll get there first. Very good. Hold course for Singapore.
Drake leaned back in his chair. Let these 6 ships jump. If they came into the middle of his fleet, he'd surround and destroy them. If they came up along one of his flanks, he'd drive them off with concentrated firepower. But instead of jumping, the enemy ships kept charging on an intercept path that would bring them right up the Z-axis at Drake's underbelly. He was suspicious, guessing they would try some trick at the last moment. But to be safe, he'd